Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Jeff Demuy and I'll be reading Shindig magazine here on Sight into Sound Radio. Our program is called Shindig, the Lost and Found Heroes of the Golden Age of Rock and Roll. Shindig magazine specializes in articles about famous and obscure musicians from the 1960s on. We'll be hearing the stories and listening to the songs from artists old and new. Welcome, and today we'll be reading from Shindig magazine issue number 26. Today we're going to learn a lot about a band called the Small Faces. They were hugely popular in Britain in the 60s, and members went on to make some of the most popular music in the United States afterwards. However, here in America we don't know a lot about them, so we're going to change that today. Let's start by listening to their one big American hit. This is from 1967, the Small Faces with Ichiku Park.
Bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been.
What did you do there?
I got high.
What did you feel there?
Where I cried.
Why the tears there?
Tell you why.
It's all too beautiful.
Love that song. Well, you may need a flowchart for this, but I'm going to try and make it easy before we jump into our article and explain who's who in the Small Faces. They got started in London in 1965, and there were four key members. The main singer, songwriter, and lead guitarist was a guy named Steve Marriott. In 1969, when he left the Small Faces, he started a bunch of other projects, the most successful of which here in the U.S. was a band called Humble Pie. So let's listen to one of my favorite Humble Pie songs. This is 30 Days in the Hole featuring Steve Marriott.
Black.
And that's a song from Steve Marriott, the lead singer and guitarist and one of the principal songwriters of The Small Faces. Of course, after he left the band, strangely enough, they hired Rod Stewart and Ronnie Lane to take over guitar and lead vocal duties and changed their name from The Small Faces to just Faces. Let's hear a Faces song from 1971. This is one of my favorites, featuring Rod Stewart on vocals, Stay With Me.
We'll be right back.
All right, so that's the story about the small faces begatting the faces, Humble Pie, and the other members of the band. Kenny Jones on drums went on to play for The Who. Ronnie Lane moved to Austin and recorded a series of really interesting albums. And then finally Ian McLagan, the keyboardist, played with the Rolling Stone, among other people, and also moved to Austin. So some Texas connections. Let's get started with our article about the small faces. This is called Things Are Going to Get Better, and it's by Derek O'Halloran. 1966 was a good year for rock music and a very good year for the small faces. All or Nothing hit the top spot. They became fashion icons and cemented their reputation as one of the most popular live draws in the UK. But there was a dark side. With success came pop adulation and a requirement to play the game, something they felt very uneasy about. All of us, at every single moment, were trying to get away from this teeny bopper image. And then along came Andrew Luke Oldham and Immediate Records. Derek O'Halloran charts the band's transition from lovable rogues to sonic visionaries, their desire to be taken seriously shaping their most creatively satisfying period. British manager Don Arden may never have dangled a small face by the ankles from a fifth-floor balcony, but the relationship between the notorious manager and his charges had certainly soured by the time he took what they considered to be a demo and handed it to Decca Records as the group's sixth single release in November of 1966. My Mind's Eye went to number 4 in the UK charts, making it the Small Faces' third top 10 smash, but the group members were far from happy. For months, they've been trying desperately to shake off the perceptions of the band as a superficial pop outfit. Let's go ahead and listen to that song, My Mind's Eye. This is a big favorite of mine from their early period. All of us, every single moment, were trying to get away from this teeny bopper image, remembers drummer Kenny Jones. If anything, we should have been likened to someone like the Yardbirds or Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton. All those guys had got these rougher rock and roll type images, and that's what we honestly were. When we played together privately, we'd be really heavy and wild, off the wall. It was great. But when we did shows, it was literally doing the hits. When we were promoting ourselves, we were doing ourselves no good by continuing to promote our teeny bopper image, and it wouldn't leave us. We'd go up on stage and play this rinky-dink stuff, and that's probably why Don Arden released that record, and he put us right back into our pop stuff. In May 1966, the Small Faces had set up base in a house together at 22 Westmoreland Terrace, Pimlico, London, where their collective friendship, already tight, deepened further. It was kind of like our own little office, Jones recalls, our own world. We would invite people there that were in the industry, other musicians. Paul McCartney would be sitting there one day, Mick Jagger the other day, or all of them together. I had my own room, but I very rarely stayed there because you couldn't get any sleep. The Small Faces' reputation as a hit-making band had been established through the success of their first 5 singles, 4 of which had landed in the UK top 20. Now, in the super dynamic London music scene of mid-late 1966, myriad new influences and experiences were combining to shift the group's focus away from the sharp, soulful pop of their early days to a more mature and expansive mod psych sound, one which they believed to be a truer expression of themselves and their surroundings. At Christmas, after a dispute over money, the Small Faces announced their departure from Don Arden's company, Contemporary Records. They continued to fund their own recordings as 1967 dawned, while legal and managerial issues were sorted out. A complicated process that was mired in controversy, details of which are still disputed to this day. Creatively, though, the group seemed unencumbered as the final few tracks that were put out by Decca to cash in on their erstwhile client's success attest. These songs, including the single Patterns, revealed a new introspective approach to lyric writing and an enthusiastic embrace of both the new studio technologies and the widening palette of pop that typified the era. Most striking of the lot was Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a rumination on the innocent joys of childhood and the cynicism of old age, its swirling psych sound punctuated by drowsy stabs of brass. The song appeared in May 1967 on Decca's retrospective Small Faces album, From the Beginning, along with another lysergic outing, That Man, both sitting incongruously alongside old sing-along tunes like the group's debut single, What You Gonna Do About It, and a handful of soul covers. Let's go ahead and listen to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow from the Small Faces 1967 right now. You're listening to the psychedelic sounds of Shindig, the lost and found heroes of the golden age of rock and roll, here on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Let's continue on with our article about the Small Faces. While the band had been fueled by marijuana and speed in the early phase of their career, the hallucinogenic properties of acid now came to the fore. In those days, the Beatles, the Stones, everyone was doing the same thing, remembers Jones. There was this psychedelic sound coming out of everybody, so we just flowed in with it in the atmosphere of the time. You couldn't help getting caught up in it, so that's why the songs came out like that. One man willing to give the Small Faces the artistic freedom that they now craved was Andrew Luke Oldham, innovative publicist, egotistical anti-authoritarian, and infamous manager of the Rolling Stones. On trips to the United States, Oldham had seen independent American record labels like Chess and Motown successfully coexist alongside behemoths such as Columbia Records. Ever the enterprising rebel, Oldham decided to set up his own label in Britain, which would prioritize his artist's creative impulses and offer the kind of indulgence unheard of in the straight-laced mainstream British record companies. He launched Immediate Records in August of 1965, explaining its ethos to the New Musical Express. "We believe that success lies in dispensing with the accepted tradition and going against the current trend. We want to give an aura of youth. There's no room in business for an old club atmosphere. Jones recalls, Immediate was a new and fantastic off-the-wall avant-garde record company. Rather than being a part of a big corporation and all that, this was family-oriented. Labelmate P.P. Arnold, also a former member of the Ike and Tina Turner Review, testifies to the special atmosphere fostered by Oldham. It was very, very cool. We were just having a ball. We were all really, really young and really, really talented. We all liked each other. I was from the States, so I knew all about the Motown kind of thing. With Immediate, we were trying to recreate a similar kind of situation to that, where all the artists worked together and everybody wrote for each other. There were some really great in-house writers. Twice as much were writing for Andrew, and they wrote stuff for me. They wrote the tunes, and we went into the studio and recorded. The Small Faces would play. They'd sort of be like the rhythm section. There was a lot of Phil Spector sounds, big productions, but all the funky stuff was with the Small Faces. Now, you know, we just can't slide past P.P. Arnold without playing her big hit for Immediate Records. This is from 1968. It is The First Cut is the Deepest, incidentally written by Cat Stevens. That is P.P. Arnold, and can that woman sing? Continuing on with our story about the Small Faces, Jerry Shirley, who's the drummer for another Immediate act, The Apostolic Intervention, and, by the way, also later to become the drummer for Humble Pie, remembers his time there with similar fondness, though perhaps not solely for musical reasons. It was a truly wonderful place to be, very creative, each artist ready to help out the other one. Plus, the receptionist had the longest legs that Mother Nature had the good sense to create. It was worth going to the offices just to be able to sit there and dream about her legs. Bless her heart. Other associates of the Small Faces at Immediate included precociously talented wunderkind Billy Nichols, proto-proggers The Nice, and gritty blue-eyed soul man Chris Farlow. Interaction between artists was indeed fluid. They would guest on each other's sessions, share songs, and tour Europe as a collective. The Small Faces were also given unlimited recording time at Olympic Studios in Barnes. To go into the studio and to be given as much time as you like to be creative was heaven, says Kenny Jones. And that's where most of the good songs, the good sounds, started. It all joined up, in a sense, all of what we'd learned over the years. Our freedom was electrifying. Andrew Lou Goldham announced the Small Faces' arrival at Immediate Records with the release of Here Comes the Nice in June, the most blatant ode to a drug dealer to ever grace the UK Top 20. That was swiftly followed by the group's first LP for the label, somewhat confusingly titled Small Faces, the same as their Decca debut. Its 14 tracks clearly showed the band stepping away from the muscular R&B that characterized their eponymous debut. Produced by Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane, with the invaluable assistance of engineer Glenn Jones, the record's use of horn stabs of brass, flourishes of harpsichord, and deft deployment of strings amply demonstrate the wider sonic spectrum of the group. Lyrical concerns had switched from the outward-facing to the inward-searching, typified by Marriott's vulnerable Feeling Lonely and Lane's dream-inspired Green Circles. Overall, the album is a fascinating product of a kinetic creative spirit straining to transcend the limitations of pop. Not everyone was willing to go along on this journey with the band, however. While Disc and Music Echo magazine proclaimed it a good progression for the group, Music Maker sniffed, "Disappointing effort from one of Britain's best groups. Few new paths are explored, and far-out lyrics are becoming such a drag." Let's take a listen to a song from that 1967 Small Faces album. This is a favorite of mine. It's called My Way of Giving. Even better was to come. 2 months after the release of the album came Ichiku Park, another UK top 10 hit and the band's one and only single success in the United States. The song's dreamy nostalgia and celebration of pharmaceutical bliss chimed perfectly with the prevailing ethos of the summer of 1967. In a 2009 interview for the DVD Small Faces All or Nothing 1965-68, keyboardist Ian McLagan is dismissive of the record, however. He said, "Ichiku Park is one of my least favorite songs of the Small Faces, only because of the expression, 'It's all too beautiful,' and the way we sang it. It was too perky for me." Kenny Jones is a bit more charitable. "It was a different one, that. Kind of like the hippie days, caftans and that nonsense. I think it suited the times, and we quite liked that one because of the phasing effect." Hot on its heels came the song Tin Soldier, a near-perfect blend of soul and rock, its heartfelt words brilliantly matched with an inventive arrangement and immaculate production. "The Small Faces' finest moment," opined McLagan in the 2009 interview. "I don't think we cut a better track. There's a great guitar sound. Thank you, Glenn. Great playing, great lines. It's the best thing we ever did." Well, let's go ahead and listen to Tin Soldier right now. Thank you.
soldier that wants to jump into your fire. You are a look in your eye, a dream passing by in the sky. Oh, I don't understand.
Everybody always says, did Steve Marriott write that song about you, beams P.P. Arnold. I don't think he did. I think he wrote about his first wife, Jenny Rylance. I mean, he loved me, but he was madly in love with Jenny. We decided to keep our relationship more soul brother and soul sister. With the success of such a mature song reaching number 9 in the UK, which anticipated the heavier rock and serious songwriting of the impending album era, surely the Small Faces' time had come to be taken seriously by critics and fans alike. Unfortunately, the release of their next single, Lazy Sunday, in April 1968, abruptly derailed any movement in that direction. Andrew Oldham put it out as a single, says McLagan. We were on the road when we found out. That's the very last thing we needed. We were trying to get back to our roots. We were trying to be a live act, and here we had a comedy record put out. Jones shares his frustration. We were still viewed as a teeny band. That's probably the most honest reason why the Small Faces broke up. We just couldn't shake it. They would try one more time to change that perception. Let's go ahead and listen to that song, Lazy Sunday, from 1968, a kind of charming song about the Small Faces and their problems with making too much noise for their neighbors.
Wouldn't it be nice to get on with me neighbors? But they make it very clear they've got no room for ravers. Here we all are,
You're listening to the boisterous sounds of Shindig, the lost and found heroes of the golden age of rock and roll here on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. And now let's continue with the second part of our Small Faces articles. This is called Deep Joy, and it's by Carl Tweed. With their star in the ascent and their creative juices in full flow, the Small Faces entered 1968 as one of British pop's most vital forces. Yet, they still had their ace to play, and it took the form of an album that took months to pull together, looked like a tobacco tin, and sounded like nothing else around. Carl Tweed unscrews the lid on the album Odgen's Nut Gone Flick and discovers a psychedelic tragicomedy based around a campfire moment about the other half of the moon. 1967 had been pretty good for the Small Faces. By the time the Tin Soldier single was released in December of 1967, the band was already in the studio working on what would become their most fondly remembered album, Odgen's Nut Gone Flick. Putting it together was a long, drawn-out process. It didn't take a year to record, Kenny Jones is keen to clarify, but it was recorded over a year because we were constantly on the road. We had to gig at the same time. Part of the mythology that's been built up around Odgen's Nut Gone Flick stems from its origins. The band's plus assorted wives and girlfriends would go on cruises down the Thames, starting at Henley, ostensibly to write songs. Ostensibly is the operative word here. Andrew Oldham set the cruises up. He said we needed to relax, says Jones. We all went on the boat and were supposed to write songs. Not much got written, though, but on the way back, we stopped and set up a campfire. One of us, I don't remember who it was, looked up at the night sky and said, "There's only half a moon." That comment set ideas racing and eventually led to the creation of the album's fulcrum. At the heart of the band was the songwriting partnership of Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane. Sometimes Steve and Ronnie would have a song more or less done, Jones explains. Then one or the other would chip in a bit here and there, or they'd have half a song each and then they'd kind of throw them together, basically. They were a great team together writing songs. The first 4 months of 1968 were an interesting time for British bands. There was much talk of concept albums, journeys, quests, odysseys, and the like, and trying to find a post-psychedelic sound to fit the more serious times. The Vietnam War was at its height, and there was the Prague Spring, talk of student revolution in Paris, and Martin Luther King was assassinated in April. The album Their Satanic Majesty's Request, the Rolling Stones' belated attempt at psychedelia, was met with indifference when it was released in December of 1967, 6 months too late and too obviously indebted to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. The Moody Blues' Days of Future Past came out in January, staking its claim as the first concept album. Its songs describe different times of the day and night. Personally, my vote for the first concept album would go to I Hear a New World by the Blue Men, an album of outer space-inspired instrumentals from 1960, which features some of producer Joe Meek's wackiest sound effects. The contributions of Days of Future Past by the London Festival Orchestra were a worrying early example of classical music pretensions amongst pop musicians. Other notable albums released in those first months of 1968 included The Move's self-titled debut, a psych-pop tour de force. The Bee Gees' horizontal album, beautifully orchestrated pop gems, which stands up to comparison with the Beatles and the Zombies' Odyssey and Oracle, an album so gorgeous that the band can be, and have been, worthily described as an English Beach Boys. So, that was the competition, some enduring pop masterpieces as well as the odd duffer. It was into this musical climate that Immediate Records released a couple of 45s in January 1968. P.P. Arnold's If You Think You're Groovy was written and produced by Steve and Ronnie and features backing from the Small Faces. Arnold was a former Ikeette who'd signed to Immediate as a solo artist. Steve and me, we hooked up straight away, she fondly recalls today. We really liked each other as people and as artists and as singers. We used to jam together. He was amazing. I got along with everybody, but my real relationship was with Steve Marriott. There was a connection. During that first 6 to 8 months in England, that was the first time I had any friends in my life. My kids were with my mom, so I was like a teenager. It was the first time I had that kind of freedom and to be part of this whole revolution that was going on. It was really fantastic. The band reportedly recorded their own version of Groovy, with one newspaper preview of Ogden's including it in the track list, along with Be My Baby, the Ronettes classic that the band often played live, but it's yet to surface in any form. Let's go ahead and listen to a great song. This is P.P. Arnold, backed by the Small Faces, doing If You Think You're Groovy.
much for me to do and to know and to be and to be.
And that is the sound of 1968, P.P. Arnold backed by the Small Faces, and it is indeed groovy. The week after the P.P. Arnold single came Billy Nichols' Would You Believe? The 18-year-old Nichols had been signed to Immediate primarily as a songwriter, so it's odd that somebody else pinned his debut outing. Billy explains, Would You Believe was brought to us at Immediate by a songwriter named Jeremy Paul, and it blew us all away. I was just about to record the album, so Steve Marriott suggested we just go and do it. We recorded it pretty much on the spot. Although I was having the song, Steve had to put his stamp on it. The backing vocals and shout you hear were very much his way of making his mark. Again, the Small Faces were on hand to provide the robust backing and accompanied him on a promotional jaunt to Germany. The Small Faces were there when I did the Beat Club show, he smiles today, just before I went on to do my bit. Steve said he wanted to wear my jacket. Well, it was my favorite one, the buckskin cowboy jacket that I wore on the cover of the album. What am I going to wear, I said. Well, you can wear mine, and he took it off to swap. His was a white suit jacket with wide lapels, but it just didn't fit me. I was really pissed off. You can tell I'm looking a bit glum at the beginning of the clip. I didn't get it back for 6 months, and by then it was stained and shabby. I've still got it, though. The single went nowhere, but that didn't stop Immediate recording an album of the same name with Billy, which features Marriott and would go on to become one of the rarest and most sought-after artifacts of the era. The arrival of the album Odgen's Nut Gone Flake was presaged by the release of the single Lazy Sunday. Delivered by Marriott in a deliciously comic Cockney accent, the song's milieu is not too dissimilar to the Kinks' recent hit, Autumn Almanac. It revels in the minutiae of domestic life and fades out over probably the most evocative sound England has to offer, the ringing of church bells and birds singing. How exotic it must have seemed to foreign listeners trying to make sense of Mrs. Jones and her Burt's lumbago and sitting in the Kazi sussing out the moon. Kenny Jones reckons that there were similarities between Steve Marriott and the character he portrays in Lazy Sunday. He was always a bit like that. He was almost like a caricature of himself sometimes. That comes from his early acting career. He went to the Italia Conti Drama School. He was the very, very first artful dodger in the musical Oliver. He literally was an artful dodger. I think we all were a little bit. Ogden's Nut Gone Flake followed Lazy Sunday in May. It's an album of two halves, literally. Side 1, a collection of potential singles culled from various sessions over the previous few months, and Side 2, a fairy tale about Happiness Stan and his search for the other half of the moon. The public loved the music, Stanley Unwin's gobbledygook narration, and the innovative, if rather impractical, circular sleeve mimicking the design of Odgen's nut brown flake tobacco tins. Sessions had been held sporadically over the previous 6 months or so, mostly at their favorite Olympic studio in Barnes, southwest London, with occasional forays into Pye and Trident in the West End. Without ever detracting from the band's innate power, Glyn Johns was always keen to experiment in the studio, and part of the album's success is down to his input. Kenny Jones recalls, "One time we were sitting in a circle learning a song, and I was playing brushes on my drum stool. Glyn Johns came on the mic and said, 'Keep playing, keep playing.' And that's how on one song, I'm playing my drum stool." Side 1 opens up with the title track, an instrumental that reprises the band's 1965 single, I've Got Mine. With its subtle use of ominous-sounding strings, it has a filmic quality. You could imagine hearing it over the opening credits of a Cold War spy thriller. Although perhaps owing a slight debt to I Am the Walrus, you can, in turn, hear its influence on the early work of prog rock acts like Caravan and Yes. The opening bars of Afterglow of Your Love, which sound like they were grafted into the main track, feature a crooning Lane vocal, but Marriott quickly takes control. The combination of Ian McLagan's exquisitely executed electric harpsichord trills, an enraptured lyric with not a hint of irony in sight, and quite possibly Marriott's best-ever blue-eyed soul vocal, makes this a crowning achievement. Interjecting here, it's also a favorite of mine, so let's go ahead and listen to The Small Faces' Afterglow of Your Love right now.
Cares. No one can
Okay, so that is my favorite Small Faces song. Members of the Immediate Records family contributed to the recording of the album, but weren't credited. It was Steve who acknowledged my involvement on the album, explains Billy Nichols. There were no credits on the album, but he said that the backing vocals were all P.P. Arnold and Billy Nichols, which was nice. Arnold says she didn't sing on the album. I was doing my own thing. I wasn't with them every day. We came together and collaborated, but I wasn't with the Small Faces all the time. I was out there doing P.P. Arnold. Ogden sailed up the charts, reaching number one on June 29th and staying there for 6 weeks. It won numerous industry awards. We cleaned up, remembered Marriott and Terry Rawlings' All Our Yesterdays book. Andrew collected them, and we caught him on the stairs, his arms full of bits of plastic. Best artwork, best design, best album. We said, "Where the hell did you get all those?" Immediate Records label mate Jerry Shirley, who was just 17 when he was picked to play drums in Marriott's post-Small Faces band Humble Pie, is amongst the album's most public fans. My favorite Small Faces moment was having Steve Marriott give us an advance acetate copy of the Stanley Unwin side of Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, reminisces Jerry today. I was playing in a band in Cambridge called Wages of Sin, and we listened to it over and over and over again. I just couldn't get enough of it. Pound for pound, it's still my favorite album for the time. It beats them all. The album went on to influence future generations of musicians who realized they could present English-centric lyrics on parochial subjects with wit, panache, and core blimey swagger. Too many groups to mention here have used Ogden's as their template and inspiration. The next logical step would have been for the Small Faces to perform the album live. Kenny Jones expresses genuine emotion over what could have been. My biggest regret was that we never played Ogden's live in its entirety. We should have done that. We broke up at the time because one of the things was, how are we going to follow that? But if we'd stayed together, we would have worked it the same way that The Who did with Tommy. There was at least Color Me Pop, an innovative short-lived music show on the recently launched arts-based BBC Two. As its title suggests, it was made in color, at the time a novelty for the UK, which was years behind America in the take-up of new technology, and it gave groups the opportunity to perform a selection of tracks live in the studio. In those days, we would take a backing track and we'd do all the vocals live, says Jones. The Happiness Stand fairy tale concept captured the producer's imagination, and so in June of 1968, the Small Faces were invited to perform some tracks from Ogden's on the show. Stanley Unwin was there to narrate. Kenny Jones remembers the experience fondly, including the high-kicking finale. That was all mine, that was. That's the one where I was wearing my mum's green blouse or shirt. Stanley Unwin's wearing a crown. What he should have had was a Merlin-type wizard's hat, pointy, but they didn't have any in props. The crown was all they had. It blew the real thing, really. The funniest thing on that is our introduction and the guy at the end. He says some word like idiosyncrasy, and I thought, what's that? I end my conversation with Kenny Jones by asking him which songs are his favorites. I'm proud of all of them. If you think you're groovy, I like that. We never put it out, although we did record it, but I played on that for P.P. Arnold. So I'm kind of proud of that one and most of the stuff on Ogden's and everything we did on Immediate, really, because I was always experimenting and still learning. I still am. Happiness Stand is a fairy tale, and as we all know, a fairy tale has a happy ending. So let's leave the Small Faces in an ebullient mood and at the top of their game, larking away to Happy Days Toy Town on Color Me Pop on the BBC. A world of possibility awaits. And that's the end of our Small Faces show today. I hope you really enjoyed some of the music we played and got to know a little bit more about what England was like in 1967 and 68 and the roots of bands like Humble Pie and Rod Stewart and the Faces. As always, it is a pleasure to present this music and these wonderful articles from Shindig Magazine to you. Have a great week. And now we've come to the end of our program. I've been reading Shindig Magazine. I'm Jeff DeMuy, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.